Welcome to a Black Friday edition of The Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on this day after Thanksgiving. Coming up, we will talk about the top stories in state, national, and international news this week, and we will welcome the stories, the issues that you would like our two guests to discuss and debate at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guests. We are thankful to have with us Steve Prestigard, journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
And John Smart is with us, past chair of the Price County Democratic Party, a regular contributor to Fighting Bob and newspapers around Wisconsin. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
So I understand, John, it's snowing like heck up there.
It's been snowing all night.
Oh, wow.
We've got a pile of snow on the ground already.
You know, I heard that Vilas County had a winter storm warning for all day today, but apparently Price County does too.
Well, we're on the northern edge of Price County, so it seems to be coming in here too. We're closer to the snow belt, I think, in a way than Vilas County is, but yeah, it's coming.
Yeah, well,
definitely so.
That's gonna hinder your Black Friday shopping today, John.
I wasn't planning on doing any anyway.
I didn't think so, but I just had to ask. Did you have a nice Thanksgiving, John?
Yes, very nice, and I understand that you did your famous Brussels sprouts.
I did. I did. They're not so famous, but it's one dish I can make, and my husband enjoys them, so
well,
that was my contribution.
Sounded good to me.
Hey, Steve, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. We were going to make bacon-wrapped turkey, and it turned out to be more like bacon-draped turkey, but it was really good. I'm sure the leftovers for lunch today and tomorrow and Sunday and Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, et cetera, are going to be quite good. Also, I got a full night's sleep because I did not get up in order to shop anywhere on Black Friday.
Yeah, I never shop on Black Friday. Mainly, I am working usually every Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. I rarely am off on this holiday, but I'm a little bit intimidated by those doorbusters and such as well. And there are some people that were they're protesting the Black Friday starting earlier and earlier, becoming Thanksgiving Day opening of stores, including Walmart. There were some people who were saying, don't shop at Walmart, and there were workers who apparently were being encouraged to walk out and protest having to work for the wages they work for on Thanksgiving. What are your thoughts, John Smart, on the politics of Black Friday?
Well, I'm sorry that it's been reduced to politics, but in a sense, I suppose it has. And when Walmart treats its employees as badly as it does, we all have heard the statistics about how many Walmart employees are also on food stamps and getting county assistance and so forth. It just seems to me that it's kind of embarrassing that they keep pushing even further and further. And yeah, I kind of resent it. I would like to have a few holidays left alone. We wouldn't have to expect the stores to be open on Christmas Day, and I don't think they should be open on Thanksgiving either.
Your thoughts on this, Steve?
Well, I assume that Walmart isn't doing this just because some suit said, hey, how about we be open on Thanksgiving? I think it is the result of, for better or worse, it's the result of consumer demand. I don't have anything against Walmart, but I'm not going there because it's Black Friday or Black Thursday or, whatever day. I'm much more likely to shop on Small Business Saturday tomorrow, but in an economy that is growing and where there is demand for labor, people always have the option to go work somewhere else, and that forces management to think about that and about the difficulties in replacing people. But that would not be this economy right now, and that has something to do with it. But for the most part, I think Walmart's doing it because they think that there's consumer demand for it, and the fact that Target and the other big retailers are doing that also probably indicates that that's a correct decision on their part until people stop shopping the day before Black Friday.
Yeah. On Facebook, Katie writes, as a Walmart associate, I will be at work at my appointed time with a smile on my face. Would I rather be with my friends and family? Of course, but I work retail and that's how it goes. Apparently, the walkout among Walmart associates was rather low. John, what do you think in terms of the actual walkout of those employees?
Well, it was a national movement, for one thing, and I was reading something about in California. I think it was anything but low. I think they really turned out. I don't know about Wisconsin. I haven't really heard any statistics. I don't know. But it just seems that, you know, I would counter what Steve said, that it was that this is a consumer demand, you know, that we have to be, they have to be open on Thanksgiving Day and so forth. I think it's much more driven by greed than anything else, frankly.
You want to counter that, Steve?
Profit is greed, I guess, is what you're trying to say. I mean, again, if they were opened up at, say, 10 o'clock last night and nobody showed up, I guarantee you they wouldn't do it again next year. So the consumer is the one who's driving all of this, regardless of who started it. You know, if Walmart said one year, well, you know what, maybe we ought to anticipate Black Friday by being open before Black Friday, and then people show up, obviously they made the right decision, they're going to do it again. If they make that decision and nobody shows up or very few people show up, they're not going to make that decision. That's how markets work.
Steve Prestigard is a journalist and blogger, and John Smart is past chair of the Price County Democratic Party and a contributor to newspapers and to Fighting Bob. And this is our Week in Review. If there was an issue in the news this week that you would like to talk about, call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, let's talk about another issue. This actually was first mentioned in a speech in California. Governor Walker, speaking in California, talked about the agenda for Wisconsin. One of the things that he brought up is that he is also calling for an end to same-day voter registration in Wisconsin. On that item first, Steve Prestigard, do we really want to end same-day voter registration in Wisconsin?
Well, let's ask the counter question, which is, why is it that only, I think my number's right, why is it that only 10 states in this country have same-day voter registration? Now, I think he was probably generalizing when he said that there were huge rushes everywhere in polling places. I don't suspect that was the case in, you know, rural parts of the state or, you know, smaller towns or that sort of thing. But I do think, you know, I'm a little agnostic on the subject as to whether it's a huge problem. However, I would say that, you know, those people who really think they should have same-day voter registration in this state, I'd be fine to trade with keeping same-day registration in exchange for requiring voter ID.
Well, what do you think of ending same-day voter registration first, John Smart?
Well, I think it's a terrible mistake. The reason that we have voter registration at the polls, and so does Minnesota, and we're among the highest volume states in voting turnout. And I think that there's a connection there. And I think that that's good. I think we should be trying to encourage people. And I feel the same way about the photo ID business. It's just some way to discourage people from getting to the polls, and I don't think that that should be the case. I have people say it's your right to vote. My feeling is it's your obligation to vote, and you should be prepared for it, and you should study the issues and the candidates and know what you're doing. But the idea of putting impediments in the way of voting because you have to have a license to drive a car or whatever other silly argument people make, I just think is foolish. The idea is that we should try to get everybody who's qualified to be an informed voter and to please turn out and vote.
Yeah. Is this just to impede voters, Steve?
The thing is, both sides do it. You know, this is I assume it does have something to do with trying to impede voters. But Democrats do the same thing by saying, oh, Mitt Romney's never going to win, or Scott Walker's never going to win, or Scott Walker's going to be indicted as soon as he's reelected or whatever. So just a little game that the politicians seem to play. It seems to me that if you think voting, and I guess I would quibble a little bit with what John said. Yeah, I do think that voting is an obligation, but informed, I guess he did say this, informed voting is an obligation. And I think that the number of informed voters is significantly smaller than the number of voters. I would not have, you know, there is really nothing other than my death that would prevent me from voting. And if you think it's really that important, you will go before it's time to register, or before election day, if that's what's required to get registered, and get registered.
Let's take a call from Dave in Wanakee. Hello, Dave.
Hi. Well, I look at the results of the election. I see Scott Walker trying to suppress voting. Don't you think it'd be more useful for the Republicans to concentrate on a message that would resonate with voters and get them to want to vote for them instead of trying to suppress the votes of those who vote against them?
Well, Steve, react to that.
Well, if you think I'm going to defend the Republican Party as far as their 2012 campaign strategy, I'm not. I think Republicans appear to have done just fine in statewide races, given the fact that they have control of the Senate again. But, you know, as I said, you know, part of it, it has come to the point in this country, and I think this is very unfortunate, it has come to the point where elections are less about convincing people to vote for you than about maximizing your own side's turnout and minimizing the other side's turnout. And there's ways to do that. There are numerous ways to do that, and that's where we've gotten to, I think, in this country. That is not good, but that's the way it seems to be now, doesn't it?
All right, John.
I don't. I think I actually agree. I think that it's crazy to do that, to try to inhibit the vote in order to make our side win. And I'm sorry about that. I really am. There, and I also think that it has something to do with the incredible spread in partisanship in this country. It didn't used to be that way. I remember Dave Obey telling me about when he first went to the House of Representatives, and he said that they were there on weekends. He was telling me that it was not a good idea to have people go fly home to their districts on weekends, because he said the weekends ended up being from Friday through Monday and meant that the work week at the House was only 3 days. But he also said that that they were spending so much money doing that and they weren't around in Washington. He said, the example he used, and I still remember it well, was he said, if you're asked to vote against a member a member's bill on Monday morning, but you went to his kid's birthday party on Saturday afternoon, it caused you at least to stop and think about it a little bit. And I'm sorry that that sense of bipartisanship seems to have withered away.
Yeah, Richard in Kenosha is with us now. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how you doing? The only comment I wanted to make on the voter registration the same day is that, first of all, you can get it all done in one day. At the same time, and plus, I did have to produce a valid driver's license when I voted in the city of Kenosha.
When you registered?
No, I wasn't.
Well, I mean, so yes, you do have to show identification or proof of residency when you register.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's right, John Smart. That you still have to show some sort of proof of residency, but it does not have to be a government issued photo ID to register.
No, as a matter of fact, it can be a bill from the utility company or something addressed to you at that address. That's, you know, you just some kind of a proof that you actually live where you say you live. That's all.
Yeah.
Oh, because they asked me for an actual ID. You know, my driver's license. They didn't ask for any proof of residency. They asked me for my driver's license.
Well, if you didn't have a driver's
license,
yeah, I don't think they are either. But I think if you would have said, I don't have a driver's license, they would have said, we need some sort of proof of residency to register anyway. And again, do you have any comment on that, Steve?
Apparently, the poll workers didn't get the memo that voter ID has been held up in the courts, but, you know, he got the vote, so it appears to have worked out fine.
John in Sugar Camp is with us. Hello, John.
Hi, I'm the town clerk in Sugar Camp, and it seems to me we're just trying to make a problem that doesn't exist. We have voter registration up here same day, and it has never been a problem. We average 30 to 40 new people a year that come in to register, and it's not a problem. And to say let's get rid of that really denies the people an opportunity to come in, vote that day. They only have to make one trip to the town hall and register. You do have to have some sort of ID if it's a first-time registration, and we verify that, and people vote. We have about an 80 to 90% voter turnout for most of our elections up here. So I see no problem with same-day voter registration.
Yeah, and we have on Facebook, Jody on Facebook says, I was a poll worker for the November election. I was amazed at the number of people who we registered that day. To be able to vote is a right. To do away with same-day registration, making it harder to register, is to deny people that right. Governor Walker primarily is saying he thinks we need to take a look at getting rid of same-day voter registration because of the crowds at the polls on election day, and that this is overworking the poll workers, and apparently the town clerk in Sugar Camp anyway doesn't think it's necessarily causing problems. So Steve, do you think there's a big case for ending this?
Well, no offense to Sugar Camp or whatever municipality the person on Facebook works, but again, Sugar Camp or smaller towns or more rural areas are not necessarily the experience of the entire state. I guess that would be the first thought. Then the second thought is the fact that you have to make a trip to City Hall or the Village Hall or the Town Hall in advance of voting does not strike me as being a very onerous demand. The fact is that, or if my facts are correct, there's only 10 states in this country that have same-day voter ID. And I haven't heard of instances in which there have been civil rights lawsuits that claim that people are denied their right to vote because they have to register at a separate day. But again, you know, as I said, I don't think that evidently this is not an issue. The crowding thing is not an issue everywhere in the state, and maybe not even in most places in the state, since this is obviously still a relatively rural state.
So if this is overworking the poll workers, John Smart, as the governor says it is, maybe just in the big cities, maybe that's a good reason to get rid of same-day voter registration.
I don't think so. I think that, in fact, the governor was making it kind of a snide remark. He said something about how they're all retirees, and they're, he made it the implication being that they tire easily, and you can't really expect them to do this, too, because that would be overworking these poor old folks. Well, as a poor old folk myself, I don't really like that idea. I also would like to point out that Steve says that we're only, say, 10 states in the union that have this kind of voter registration. I doubt seriously if they have it in Mississippi, but I think that our voter turnout is significantly higher than that in Mississippi also.
We're going to take one last call on this issue and then move on to many others. Katie in Clinton is with us. Hello, Katie.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I used to live in the state of Pennsylvania where you had to pre-register, first of all. And when you went in, you basically had to show proof of residency, like a utility bill or a driver's license or some kind of an ID. And you filled out all your little forms and everything. And then you went home. And shortly afterwards, you actually got your registration card, your voter registration card, in the mail. I don't know whether they double-checked to make sure that you said who you were or whatnot. But then when it came time to actually vote, all I had to do was pull out my voter registration card, show that, and I voted, and it was done. It really wasn't that big of a deal that everybody seems to be making it out. Instead of having to always remember that, oh, shoot, I got to bring a utility bill or I need to bring something, you just had a voter registration card.
Yeah, well, Katie, though, let's say there are students or other people on election day haven't gotten around to registering yet.
It didn't matter where I lived, though. I had a voter registration card for the state of Pennsylvania.
All right, so you're bringing up what Pennsylvania did, even though I think Pennsylvania is working on voter ID, too, right now. Any comment on that, John Smart?
No, not really. Every state has got somewhat slightly different registration forms. I lived in Virginia, and that had a different registration than we have here. But the point is that in Wisconsin and a few other states, This same-day registration means that we get more people out to vote, and it seems to me that should be the determination.
Yeah. Steve?
Well, again, as the caller pointed out, you know, I think making two trips instead of one on same-day registration, if you really think it's important enough, it's really not particularly onerous to register in advance of, and, you know, essentially you have to do that anyway, I believe, if you are, you know, if your address is changing. So, you know, I'm not sure you can do that on the same day.
We are reviewing the news of the week, and we will move on to some other issues, including some other priorities for Wisconsin, according to Governor Walker, items that he revealed in a speech last Friday in California. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We're also going to talk some about the ceasefire in the Middle East, and we'll also talk about ongoing criticism from some Republicans that UN Ambassador Susan Rice is unfit to serve as Secretary of State after Hillary Clinton is expected to leave that post. So these issues and more coming up on this edition of The Week in Review, plus whatever issues you would like to discuss at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Governor Scott Walker unveiled major new policy initiatives on Friday night in a speech in California, including decreasing taxes, boosting the school voucher program, and requiring Wisconsin schools, technical colleges, and universities to meet certain benchmarks to earn state funding. We'll see what our two Week in Review guests have to say about some of these initiatives. But first, John Smart, do you have any problem that the governor made these announcements in a speech in California?
Yes, I do. I think he should be making such policy statements here at home. I thought that was kind of curious, but I suppose it was a big deal for him to be invited to the Reagan Library, so he figured, well, he'd try to make some news while he was there. He seems to be very determined to make news wherever he goes. But that whole business, get onto the subject of funding for education, and that's a real hot point with me, because as I tell people over and over, people tell me, well, we have to cut funding for education or for anything else because we're in the middle of a recession and everybody has to take their hit and all of that. And my answer to that is, if you think cutting education will in any way increase our economic stability or growth development, you're crazy, because that's what we actually should be stressing. We should be focusing on educating our young people, and we're not doing it. And the attacks on teachers have caused a strange reaction. I personally have talked to a number of college students who have changed their majors, who were in education but have switched out of it because they just look at the future and think, I don't think I want to be a teacher. They're being attacked from all sides. And I think that it's a very dangerous game that the governor is playing.
Yeah, now is he really talking about cutting education? He's talking about boosting school vouchers but requiring schools to meet benchmarks in order to, you know, get the state funding. Is that the same as cutting?
Well, in a sense it is. And the school voucher program is scary because that's been taught. We all know what's happened in Milwaukee and Racine with that, and I don't think that it's something that we ought to be developing. We need public education that allows every child to be educated in a public school if they want to. If they want to go to a parochial school or their parents want them to, fine, they pay for that. But I don't think that the state should be paying for that, and that's why I have a problem with vouchers. And as far as the schools having to prove that they're doing a quality job in order to get state funding is a sure way to kill schools. I mean, if you say that if your students are not passing a certain level of examination, we're going to cut your funding, well, that guarantees that school is going to fail. And that doesn't seem to me to be a logical solution at all.
Steve, your thoughts on, I guess, school funding and education reform, but also do you think there's anything wrong with Governor Walker making these announcements in a speech in California?
Well, if I can... if I can channel my inner Captain Renault, I am shocked to find politicians promoting themselves.
Yeah, so
that's my comment about California. As far as school issues go, I noticed that the previous administration apparently didn't think it was very important that schools would actually have to demonstrate that they're actually doing what they're in existence to do. It is the Walker administration that, with the Department of Public Instruction, created the school report card, and they were being prodded by the U.S. Department of Education to demonstrate that students are actually learning things. And, you know, all that's about is about taxpayer accountability. And I am really, I shouldn't be surprised, I guess, but I find it weird that somebody would actually be against the idea of schools having to earn the taxpayer dollars that they get. You know, I've seen the taxpayer report cards. It's only one, obviously, in a few years. You know, when you have a few years to be able to compare, that'll be more useful. But I think if you look at the school report cards as an example, that might be actually the most important thing that the Walker administration has developed, because it demonstrates the requirement of accountability to taxpayers, and taxpayers are the people who are paying for the schools. As far as the voucher thing goes, and obviously that's really just an issue in southeast Wisconsin, I don't know how in the world you wouldn't believe that any kind of alternative is a better alternative than the state of Milwaukee public schools right now. They spend the most amount of money by far of any school district in this state with the worst results. And if parents have the opportunity to have their kids educated at a school that will do a better job than the MPS schools do, I don't know why you wouldn't support that unless you're just, you know, in lockstep with the education establishment, basically.
Well, we need to move on to some other issues. Did you want to make a quick response to that, John Smart?
No, I think that we pretty much covered it.
All right. The governor also mentioned in this speech that he plans to focus on massive tax reform. His administration also announced this week that the upcoming budget will have a $467 million surplus, and this is leading some to speculate that maybe there will be an income tax cut for Wisconsin citizens. Do we need an income tax cut, Steve Prestigard?
Well, let's see. We have this, I believe it's now the fifth highest state and local taxes in the country, so the answer would be yes. I'm eager to see what, to use the quote, massive tax reform looks like, at least according to the Walker administration. You know, I obviously, because of my professional background, pay a lot of attention to business climate comparisons. And since the Walker administration, Wisconsin has improved from the bottom quarter to about halfway or so middle of the pack in the country. But in each of the business climate comparisons, they still talk about how poor the tax climate is. And it's not merely business taxes, but it's personal income taxes as well. Given the number of companies in this state that are organized as S corporations are somewhat similar, where the company doesn't pay taxes, but its owners do. So I think that's important for that reason. I think it's also important to have tax reform in this state, considering that our federal taxes are going to go up on January 1st once the tax cuts of a decade ago go away, which they will.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any concerns about a massive tax reform in Wisconsin, John Smart?
If we use the word reform to mean what it's supposed to mean, no. And I think that we're going to get national tax reform also, and I think that it's necessary. Reform would ideally just mean that it would develop more equity and fairness in the taxing structure, and that should work on both the national and the state level, and I'm all in favor of it. I somehow suspect that this governor means something entirely different from that, though.
Let's move on to another issue. This week, Governor Walker is assuring us that there is a campaign firewall in his office. That defense comes after allegations in court this week that Walker's gubernatorial campaign and official offices in Milwaukee County were repeatedly commingling their work during the 2010 campaign for governor. Walker maintains that a daily conference call between county and campaign workers was legitimate and routine for streamlining communication. This kind of came out in the sentencing of one of his former aides in this John Doe investigation that was looking into whether county workers were doing campaign work on the taxpayer dollar. And I'm wondering, John Smart, if you think this is a big deal or not.
Oh, I think it's a very big deal, and I think it's growing. It's going to be an even bigger deal. And I want to give credit to the district attorney's office in Milwaukee for handling it as well as they have. They've maintained extraordinary secrecy, as everybody knows. The news media and the governor's office have been trying desperately to get information from them. And they waited until the sentencing hearing for Kelly Reinfleisch before they pulled all of the stops out and started talking about some of the other information that they have. It's going to be an ongoing investigation, and I think that the governor should be essentially quaking in his boots at this point. I don't know where it's going to go. Nobody knows where it's going to go. But again, I would like to give credit to the district attorney in Milwaukee and his office for following up on it as diligently as they are.
Yeah, why do you think, John, that the governor should be quaking in his boots?
Because I think it's inevitably going to turn out that he was very much aware of all of this collusion that was going on in the county executive's office while he was running for governor, and the fact that there were people on public payroll who were working on his campaign. And I think that we know that that's illegal, and I think that's what was going on, and I think that the proof will come out that he was aware of it.
Well, do you think he should be quaking in his boots, Steve?
No. I look at it this way. This is an investigation, and by the way, I look at it as though this is an investigation that has taken 2 years to do. That's the first thing. And if Walker did something illegal, then he ought to be indicted, and he hasn't been indicted yet. And I think after a two-year-long investigation, he's not going to be indicted. I think it is naive to expect that, you know, lawyers who are much more familiar with state law than anybody listening here, who also probably observed what happened to Scott Jensen and Chuck Quala in the caucus scandal, would not have figured out a way that meets legal scrutiny to not violate state law in, you know, commingling public pay and a public function like the county executive's office in Milwaukee and Walker's campaign for governor. I just think it's ridiculous to think that they wouldn't have seen what happened to Chuck Quala and Scott Jensen and say, we need to figure out how to avoid this, you know, in a legal sense. After a two-year-long investigation, I think it's highly unlikely that they're going to get anything to stick to Scott Walker.
We are reviewing the news of the week with Steve Prestigard and John Smart. We will move on to some other issues in just a moment or two, plus our Week in Review quiz. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's time now for the Week in Review quiz. While millions of Americans stuffed themselves with turkey yesterday, two lucky birds enjoyed being left off the menu. President Obama pardoned them on Wednesday to carry on that annual White House tradition. However, only one of these two turkeys, only one was named the National Thanksgiving Turkey. What is its name? What is the name of the turkey that was deemed the National Thanksgiving Turkey this year? You can guess, and we will randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, and you will be given a book that we featured on the program recently. 1-800-642-1234 is the number if you want to guess the name of the National Thanksgiving Day turkey this year. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. So we'll give you about 10 minutes or so to guess, and we will reveal the answer and the winner at the end of the program. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine talking with John Smart and Steve Prestigard in this Black Friday edition of our Week in Review. We will move on to some other issues now. Let's You know, I think we should let's talk a little bit more state issues. We have the state's largest business group pressing for new mining legislation. It recently led a tour of two mining industry giants, Caterpillar and Joy Global, into Wisconsin to underscore the importance of mining to the Wisconsin economy. Apparently, there is an effort to not only change the mining laws when it comes to opening up an iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin, but there's some talk that we should just change the tough regulations in general on other kinds of mines as well. John Smart, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that we have to be very careful about doing this because there is danger. And one example is over in Minnesota. They're now having their studies going on up on the Iron Range that there seems to be an increased incidence of mesothelioma in a couple of the mines that are up there. There are a lot of different things, health concerns and environmental concerns, that need to be brought into this. And I think rushing into it is a mistake. The bill that was passed before by the assembly was basically written by the industry itself, and it was a lack of regulation more than it was a regulation. And if we've got tough standards right now, I think we should stick to it until we can actually reform the legislation. I think that Tim Cullen is on the right track, and I'm very proud of Bob Jauch up here in the Northwoods for keeping an eye on our environment, and I think that it just needs to be done slowly so that we don't make any more mistakes. What's happened in Minnesota and Michigan, they've both tightened the regulations that they've had on the books for years, and for very good reasons. As I said, one of them being this incidence of mesothelioma. So I think that we should not be rushing into things like they tried to do during the last session.
Steve.
Well, you better get used to that, because I think that's what's going to happen. The results of the November 6th election, you know, have given Republicans control of the state Senate by not merely a one-vote margin. So even if Dale Schultz decides to not favor what ends up happening, assuming the rest of the Republicans go in line, that's going to end up passing. I find it interesting that the Democrats have apparently, you know, this is kind of a battle of Democratic constituent groups, if you think about it, because you're talking about environmentalists basically having succeeded over union workers. Caterpillar, after all, is a huge employer in Milwaukee. They are one of the world's leaders in mining equipment, and essentially the legislature last session, by failing to pass mining legislation, said, well, we don't care about that, and we don't care about jobs up in the northwest part of the state, which has significantly higher unemployment than the state as a whole. But, you know, all you have to do is look at who's in charge in the legislature and what the margin is, and expect that, you know, the assembly's version is from last year is probably going to pass more or less like that, unless the assembly GOP changes its mind about that.
Well, we need to talk about some national and international issues. Let's talk first about U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton going to the Mideast, meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and announcing this ceasefire in the Middle East. John Smart, it seems to be holding for the most part.
It seems to be breaking down a little bit today.
Oh, is it?
I wonder whether a ceasefire can actually exist at this point. And it's becoming more and more a difficult situation. I don't know what the answer is. I don't think anybody does. But it's not really working. I give Secretary Clinton great credit, as I do Mohamed Morsi, the president of Egypt, and Mr. Netanyahu. I think they're all working toward trying to do something about it. But there are an awful lot of angry people in the middle who are going to continue to lob bombs on one another, and I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, I saw that there had been one shooting of a Palestinian, I believe, by an Israeli, but I didn't know there was more than that. But anyway, your thoughts on...
We can all hope.
Yeah. Steve Prestigard, the ceasefire in the Middle East, and for that matter, Hillary Clinton's role in it.
I don't Well, I'm not sure what the purpose of a ceasefire in one part of the Middle East is when, from what I understand, there are bombs going off in buses in Tel Aviv. So I'm a little skeptical about a ceasefire actually succeeding even right now. But, you know, if your position was there is no such thing as peace in the Middle East, I think that history would validate that. Unfortunately, I think that there will never be peace in the Middle East until those who align themselves with the Palestinian cause decide that, well, you know, they don't want to destroy Israel anymore. That sounds one-sided, but that happens to be the case. Until people on that side decide that, you know, we're not going to try to destroy Israel anymore. Israel has a right to exist. Until that day happens, there isn't going to be peace in the Middle East.
Also, in other news, a group of 97 House Republicans sent a letter to President Obama this week saying that UN Ambassador Susan Rice misled the nation about the attack on the U.S. consulate in Libya, making her unfit to be a candidate to succeed Secretary of State Clinton. Apparently, Hillary Clinton very well might leave that post soon of Secretary of State, and it's rumored that UN Ambassador Susan Rice would be the leading candidate to take that job. Your thoughts on this, Steve, first?
You know what? If I was Susan Rice, I wouldn't take the job, and the reason is I think the best thing you can say about those Sunday TV appearances where she said one thing and the truth was clearly different. Was that the Obama administration basically hung her out to dry. And if that's the idea of, you know, loyalty on the part of the Obama administration, I wouldn't take it. I think that the Obama administration has had a bad response to basically everything that's happened in the Middle East in about the last however long it's been since the Arab Spring started. And, you know, if they really wanted to give people confidence that this country is doing the right thing in this administration, I would find someone who's not in the Obama administration right now as a replacement for Hillary Clinton.
Do you think that Rice is unfit to serve as Secretary of State?
I don't know if she's specifically unfit. I just think that they need somebody different. They need someone who's not connected to the this president administration. Not saying that they should get a Republican necessarily, but I think the Obama administration has literally messed up everything since the Arab Spring movement started. They've read it wrong, they've responded wrong, and you know, it may be unfortunate that Susan Rice kind of has become the scapegoat in this sense for this, but that's what happens.
John Smart?
I don't even know where to begin with all of this. No, I disagree with Steve completely. I think the administration has handled it as well as anybody could. As far as this particular incident, one, Hillary Clinton has not resigned. She said several years ago that she would probably only serve out the first term of the president, but she hasn't made any noises about resigning yet. Nobody has ever recommended or suggested that Susan Rice was in line to succeed her. And none of this is based on anything except rumors and gossip. And I just think it's kind of dumb. As far as what Ambassador Rice said on television, she was saying basically what the State Department and the CIA told her to say, which is information that they had. At that point, remember, that was right after the attack in Benghazi. And what she was saying was, at this point, this is what we know, and that was true. That was exactly what we did know. It seemed to have started out as a popular uprising against the United States mission there, and perhaps Al-Qaeda got into it because they found some other people were going there, but at the beginning, at least, that was not really, they couldn't really show that or prove that.
Of course.
And I don't think that they have yet. I think it's still going on, and I think that there will be an ongoing investigation into that. But I do not think that Ambassador Rice in any way misspoke or lied or did anything of the sort. And again, the whole thing is based on a rumor anyway, so I think it's kind of silly.
Well, here's David Petraeus, ex-CIA director David Petraeus, told Congress last Friday that that classified intelligence showed that the raid on the U.S. consulate in Libya was a terrorist attack, but his administration withheld the suspected role of al-Qaeda to avoid tipping off al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. So, Steve Prestigard, that's their story, and they're sticking to it.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I believe the story either, but because there are, shall we say, there are incentives for them to not tell the entire truth in this instance. And the fact is, you're talking, you know, John talked about the whole thing being a rumor. We don't know exactly what Petraeus said in testimony because it's all secret. So, you know, how do we know that any reporting about that has been accurate? But on the other hand, if you're suggesting that the CIA messed up also, I think that the CIA's record over the decades would certainly validate that rule or that view as well. But I can't say that I find General Petraeus' comment to be exactly credible, and I can think of reasons that are independent of the Middle East for that to be the case.
John?
I don't think we need to belabor this one any further. I think that, first of all, what General Petraeus said last week was not exactly, they would have more information than they did when Ambassador Rice appeared on television. And I assume that there will be more information coming out as there is more information discovered. And it's very wise for them to keep it secret. You don't want to spread too many stories for al-Qaeda or anybody else to pick up on. I would also like to comment on the use of the word terrorist. It seems like some people talk about terrorist as being anybody who throws a bomb, and there are others who think terrorist means some kind of an organized scheme to try to, you know, whatever, do whatever. And I just think that the word is being overused and misused, and I think it's getting kind of silly.
All right, well, it's time to reveal the answer to our We Can Review quiz. What is the name of the National Thanksgiving turkey this year? The name, Cobbler. Cobbler is the name of our turkey this year. Mary in Richland Center is our quiz winner. Congratulations, Mary. You'll be offered one of the books we featured on the program recently. For the first time, the public got to vote on the White House's Facebook page for which of the two birds that the president pardoned this week would be the national turkey. For some reason, they chose Cobbler over Gobbler. Both birds will spend the rest of their lives at Mount Vernon. So there you go. You know, I wanted to ask you both in the remaining minute that we have, and I'm kind of springing this on you. I'm scheduled to interview Governor Walker on our state capitol report on Monday between 7 and 7:30. What question, John Smart, would you want to ask the governor about current issues?
I guess I would ask him why he decided to reveal information about his agenda for the state of Wisconsin while he was speaking at the Reagan Library in Simi, California.
All right. And Steve Prestigard, what question would you ask the governor?
Well, unlike a political question, I'd really like to ask a policy question, which is, when is this state going to do things to improve the business climate to the point where it's a supposed great accomplishment to get only to midway among the 50 states? That's my question.
All right. I got them both down, and I'm going to try to get them in on Monday. Thanks very much to both of you for being with us. I hope you have a great rest of your holiday weekend.
Thanks, Joy, and thanks, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Have a good weekend.
Yep, good weekend to both of you. John Smart is past chair of the Price County Democratic Party, and Steve Prestigard is a journalist and blogger. Thanks to both of them for joining us. Thanks to Rob Ferret, to Amanda Magnus, and to Bill Martins, who produce these programs. And thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come here on the Ideas Network. And again on Monday on our State Capitol Report from 7 until 7:30, Governor Walker is scheduled to join the show. He'll talk about budget plans, talk about his plans regarding same-day voter registration, and much more. That's Monday morning from 7 until 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.